these are the poorest households in the village. They're destitute along many dimensions. So they don't own any assets that would enable them to earn an income. They have children who are engaged in child labor or in begging. They don't have any access to credit or any earning member in the household.
Hi, welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. If poor people are poor because they started poor and are then caught in a poverty trap without money to migrate for work or start a business or even go to school, a one-time grant might be life-changing. That's the thinking behind programs to target the ultra-poor. But is the impact of this big push genuinely permanent? A recent paper tracks the effect of one of these programs after 4, 7 and 10 years. Garima Sharma of MIT was one of the researchers and she joins me now. Garima, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi Tim, thank you for having me.
What are the day-to-day lives of the ultra-poor like if they're stuck in this poverty trap?
As the name suggests, these households are really quite poor. At the time that they were identified, most of them are actually widows. So they've lost their husbands. They are female-headed households for the most part. And if you look at the selection criteria for these households, they're destitute along many dimensions. So they don't own any assets that would enable them to earn an income. They have children who are engaged in child labor or in begging. They don't have any access to credit or any earning member in the household. At the time that they were identified, first, the way they were identified was people in the village got together and said, okay, these are the poorest households in the village. And then they had to meet the selection criteria, meaning they couldn't have any earning member or assets really. So they're very poor. They earn only a little over $1 a day.
I touched on it a little bit in the introduction, but why is this trap so hard to escape?
Households are stuck at a very low level of investment, right? So it requires a big push to spur them out of this trap and enable a cycle of investment, earnings, and savings that allow them to eventually escape poverty. The challenge is there are many constraints that keep them in this trap. And the program tries to alleviate many of them at the same time. So not only does it provide an asset for investment, it also teaches the households how to use the asset to earn an income. It provides them with consumption support, because something else that we know is as soon as very poor households are struck by a shock, they tend to sell the assets that they have. So that's another thing that keeps them trapped in poverty, is even if you have an asset, you have a negative shock, you end up selling that asset. So the program provides them with consumption support to be able to mitigate this type of scenario. And then, of course, it also provides them access to saving. So traps are hard to escape because there are many constraints that prevent them from escaping. And the program helps because it alleviates all of them at the same time.
Yes, we are seeing more of these big push programs to target the ultra poor, aren't we? Because, unfortunately, there are people who are extremely poor in many places in the world. How common are they now? And where do you see them?
In 2018, about 43 countries were offering some version of this program. And it covered over 3 million households. And between 2018 and now, that number has surely risen. So they are extremely common now in developing countries, and millions of households are covered by them.
Now, we haven't explained yet what this big push is, what this grant is. Is it given as cash or is it given in some other way?
So there are four parts to the program. The first is a large asset transfer, and that's the biggest part. And households mostly get to choose what asset they like, but typically they end up choosing livestock. So that's one.
Okay.
The other part of the program is this cash grant or a consumption support grant that over a course of, in our case, 30 weeks, gives them a minimal stipend to sustain a very minimal level of consumption such that they don't sell the asset. The third component of the program is training. So over 18 weeks, program staff visit them to teach them how to use the asset, but in general also train them in life skills. And then the final part of the program is access to savings. So the households are given a bank account as well.
Now, tell me about the program that you particularly evaluated. Where is it and what sort of long-term effects were you looking to measure?
Right. So we evaluated something which is called the Targeting the Ultra Poor program, which was pioneered by an organization called BRAC in Bangladesh. In India, which is our setting, it was run by an NGO called Bandhan in West Bengal. And Bandhan, what they did was they first identified the poorest households by asking villagers who are the poorest households, and then they had to meet some eligibility criteria. Then half of them were randomized into the treatment group and given the program. And we wanted to see how this affects over the long term their consumption, income, health, as well as financial inclusion.
Thankfully, over the long term, there is also some encouraging economic development that affects the poorest people in India. Does this, however, make your evaluation hard to do because it becomes hard to isolate the effects of your program from the effects of economic development in general?
This really is the beauty of randomized control trials because although all treated as well as control group households are experiencing, as you said, the positive effects of general economic development, the fact that the treated group, which was randomly selected, gets the program and the control group doesn't, means that we are able to attribute any long-term differences between these groups to the program itself. And in fact, we do observe that the control group improves their well-being over the long term. So over 10 years, their per capita consumption, for example, goes from about $1 a day to about $3 a day. So they do escape extreme poverty. But it turns out that treated households end up doing even better. So they're consuming 20% more than control households, even 10 years later. So that's an effect of the program beyond general economic development.
Tell us more about these impacts on consumption, health, income for the treated groups.
We track consumption, income, and health at 4, 7, and 10 years. Mm-hmm. We find that 10 years later, treated households consume about 20% more than control group households. They earn about 30% more than control group households. Mm-hmm. And they also tend to have better physical and mental health. So they're less likely to miss work because they're more able to do their daily activities of living. They have higher levels of life satisfaction, lower periods of worry. And they're also able to, as a consequence of being in better physical and mental health, spend more time on productive activities. So 10 years later, they're spending about an hour more every day on these productive activities. And of course, they feel better about their lives. So self-reported measures of well-being also go up for these households.
What's the mechanism? How is this working that we get these changes? And does it work in a different way at first than, I guess it must do, than it does later on in this 10-year cycle?
Right. So here we actually find something very interesting, which is that initially treated households are doing better than the control group because they use the asset that was transferred to them to earn more income. But over time, they shift to other activities. So by 7 years, they have shifted into microbusiness and are earning higher income because of these microbusiness activities. 10 years later, they have shifted into wage employment and particularly into migrating at higher rates. So they're earning higher incomes than the control group, but it's no longer because of the asset that was transferred, but rather they seem better able to take advantage of just natural opportunities that arose in the economy. And you say that it must be that this is how they work, but actually this is contrary to a large literature on poverty trap models, which tends to envision an escape from poverty as, okay, there's a one-time investment that shifts households into a different mode of production. But what we observe is it's not this one-time change, but rather over time, they're transitioning into doing different things, but just more of them and earning more from them.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? But Garima, does it really matter exactly how a program like this works, as long as it works?
I think it does matter, right? Because these programs are quite expensive and they're being replicated all over the world. They're also being scaled all over the world. So it's useful from a policy perspective to understand if there are particular components of the program that are more important than other components, or if there are particular situations in which the programs work and other situations in which they don't work. It's also useful. So in the backdrop of these ultra-poor programs, governments are also transferring cash to individuals. And cash is cheaper to transfer than this ultra-poor program, right? Because you just give the money directly to households. So it's useful to think about, okay, why do these programs work? Would cash work just as well as this type of program? And benchmarking the effects of these programs against that is also something that's quite useful to know. And of course, if we want to scale these programs, it's useful to understand why they work, because that will inform us about whether they would also work at scale. And I think the current state of research really is trying to understand how they benchmark against cash transfers and what are the mechanisms that make them work in certain situations versus others.
So we have seen some evaluations over shorter timeframes for these programs, but I guess because they are so expensive, it must be important for the future funding of these programs to be able to demonstrate these sustained benefits over 10 years.
Yes, the big picture question is whether households may have been able to escape poverty on their own over the long run. So therefore, being able to track how these programs affect the treated households over the long run compared to the control is really quite important, because the control tells us what would have happened to these households had they been left to their own devices. If it turns out that the program has no impact at 10 years, because the control group catches up with the treated group, that means maybe we didn't need the program to begin with. So it's really important to have these long-term impacts so that we're able to see if the program actually helps or if households may have been able to escape poverty on their own.
So with all the evaluation that you've done, if I put you in charge of one of these programs, how would you do it to be able to maximize those long-term benefits?
One thing that we know is that the asset and the training are quite important components of the program. In fact, there's a study in Ghana that tries to see if the asset by itself without the training helps, and it turns out that it doesn't. So both of them are quite important. But what the asset could be and what type of training might be effective could possibly vary by context. So I would think about the context and what type of asset transfer makes sense there. And the second thing I would think about, this is somewhat more speculative, but in these programs, as well as in other programs to alleviate poverty or help the poor in developing countries, what we are starting to realize is that some households or some people might benefit more than others. For example, with the TUBE program in Bangladesh, what we found is that the households who were benefited were those that were pushed right over some threshold level of investment. In the microcredit literature, the people who are benefited through access to microcredit are mostly gung-ho entrepreneurs, so those who already had businesses and were able to invest in those businesses. So for these programs, are there particular households, even within the ultra-poor, that the program might help more versus other types of programs like maybe cash transfers might help other households more? So thinking about targeting these programs in a customized way, I think is a really exciting area for both research as well as policy.
Absolutely. It is a very exciting area. And I think the first time that we've covered this on VoxDev Talks, what have we been doing all of this time? Garima, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim.
The paper is called The Long-Term Effects of the Targeting the Ultra-Poor Program. And the authors, it's an all-star cast here, Abhijit Banerjee, Esther Duflo, and Garima Sharma. You just heard from her there. This has been a VoxDev Talk. Now, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. Go on, do it now. And when you subscribe, you've got all of our past episodes ready to listen to. You will also be able to find those past episodes at voxdev.org, where you will find articles about the papers we feature.